We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 16th of April, 2022, and this is a rare pre-recorded show. First of all, if you didn't tune in on Tuesday at 15 UTC for Hear Now the Words, I encourage you to go back and listen to the archive, because I was reading from a book entitled Spacecraft Designer, which is a kind of biography of Sergei Korolev, or Korolyov to give his name in the Ukrainian form, I guess, who was very much the moving spirit behind the Soviet space program, and whose R-7 rocket launched the first satellite, launched the first man into space, and continues to carry people into space to this very day, despite several attempts to replace it. And that was, of course, in memory of the fact that the 12th of April is the anniversary of Gagarin's flight. Poyakhali! Now, I've mentioned before that I read in the Wall Street Journal sometimes, and it really tends to bother me. You know, for example, there is a piece about houses in West Palm Beach are trading for multiples of their prices just a few years ago. And I'm thinking, isn't the great claim of capitalism that it creates prosperity? And doesn't prosperity consist, more or less, in more people being able to afford more things? Then, the Wall Street Journal, which is practically the mouthpiece of capitalism, surely shouldn't be trumpeting fewer people being able to afford things, should it? I find it a trifle confusing. But there were a couple of interesting stories, one about the Axiom Space mission to the ISS, which, depending on your definitions, may be considered the first privately organized mission to a space station. I say depending on your definitions, because of Soyuz TM-30 back in the year 2000, which was paid for by MirCorp, a private venture formed to lease and operate the Mir space station. The crew consisted of two cosmonauts from the Russian Space Agency, and the whole thing was handled pretty much as an ordinary Russian space mission. NASA ultimately forced the Russians to deorbit Mir as a condition of participation in the International Space Station. They didn't want the competition. Whereas now, NASA is actually encouraging private businesses to take over parts of the ISS, in no small part, I think, because the Russians have been threatening to pull out. Is inconsistency of policy a hallmark of the United States government? There was also a piece about Jeff Koons, the world's most expensive living artist. There's that fascination with exclusionary high prices again. Competing with various other artists to send art to the moon, and then to use the cameras on the landing vehicles to take photographs of this art, and then to sell NFTs of those photographs for millions of dollars. An enterprise I regard as highly speculative and questionable at the very least. And coming from me, that says something, since, after all, I'm generally in favor of stupid space-related marketing gimmicks. Because stupid space-related marketing gimmicks make space more present in the public mind, and thus make it easier to talk to people about space. Which is the reason I'm probably going to buy some of that Starlight space-flavored Coca-Cola, even though, as a rule, I don't drink Coke. But the one that really got me was a piece, which appeared on their reviews page, although nothing in the text suggested it was a book review, under the heading, The Coming Battle Over Clean Energy Resources. Which started out by saying something along the lines of, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has only accelerated the move away from fossil fuels to renewable resources, which had already started because of the threat of climate change. Which is overall an exceedingly questionable claim. Firstly, use of fossil fuels has not been diminishing in recent years by any measure. Secondly, the construction of large numbers of wind turbines, most of which are now rusting out and abandoned, in California during the 1980s, had nothing to do with climate change and everything to do with Reagan's tax policies. But be that as it may, the story talked about the limited geographic distribution of exotic substances such as cobalt and lithium and rare earth metals, and the limited geographic distribution of the capacity for processing them, which is another story entirely. The United States has large deposits of monazite, as does Brazil, as does India. But at present, most of the world's processing capability to extract rare earths from monazite is in China. And it went on to talk about the outsized demand of wind and solar for ordinary substances such as aluminium and steel and concrete. But nowhere in the entire piece did it discuss nuclear energy. Now maybe you're going to say, doesn't nuclear energy have its own special resource demands? Particularly substances such as uranium and zirconium, which really have few or no other industrial uses. And that is certainly true. I mean, I have seen articles claiming that any attempt to expand nuclear energy to take over a significant part of the global energy supply now provided by fossil fuels would run into serious resource constraints. But other people have broken down those articles and typically shown that the claims are extremely questionable at best. And certainly one thing is that although nuclear plants, for a given capacity, require considerably more concrete and steel than fossil-fueled power plants, nevertheless they require considerably less, let's say by a factor of 10, than do wind and solar installations to produce the same power. And that's before we even get to questions such as transmission and distribution system upgrades, which I talked about last time. But it seems to me decidedly irresponsible to write an article talking about the challenges of moving to non-fossil energy sources without even mentioning the non-fossil energy source which can slot right into existing energy systems without causing any disturbance. I should mention that I made a kind of an error and left kind of a false impression last time, talking about the proportion that generation costs bear to total cost of power in a grid system. Because I mentioned the figure of 20%, and that actually came, I think, from a discussion of the cost of fuel as a proportion of the overall cost of power in a system which heavily used coal-fired generation. Now, the cost of coal to the power generator is comprised of the cost at the pithead plus the cost of transportation. So, some power companies have saved on cost of transportation by locating their power plants at the mine mouth. But that increases the overall cost of transmission, sometimes a great deal. Of course, in power systems that are heavily fed by hydroelectricity, the cost of fuel is generally considered as nil, although in some cases there may be an accounting charge for the possible use of the water impounded behind the dam for irrigation. But contrarywise, in hydro systems, because the best sites for dams tend to be quite far away from population centers, the cost of transmission is considerably higher. Hydro still often comes out to be the cheapest power in a system, but there are plenty of counterexamples to be found where a nuclear power plant located somewhere near the load center would be a great deal cheaper. The Muskrat Falls project in Newfoundland Labrador and the Site C project in British Columbia being flagrant examples. Of course, speaking of bad energy policy, biofuels are pretty much never the economically or environmentally responsible solution to any problem. It's snake oil, or shall we say whale oil? I have mentioned in the past, in fact it's something of a recurring theme, that disturbances in the fuel supply come just short of disturbances in the food supply as sources of civil unrest. And in that vein, it is impossible for me to make even the least sense of an energy policy announcement from the President of the United States. In an attempt, apparently, to respond to public pressure over high fuel prices, Mr. Biden has announced a policy of expanding the use of E15 ethanol-blended gasoline using ethanol made from grain. This in the face of a looming cataclysm in world grain supplies. The only reason this whole ethanol-aided fuel scam has survived is that it has served as a subsidy to keep up the price of U.S. domestic grain. Well, that's not going to be a problem this year. The farmers will be able to sell every bushel that they can grow at a price considerably above anything they've seen in the recent past. Why do I use the word cataclysm? Well, dear friends, Russia and Ukraine are two of the largest grain exporters in the world. The Ukrainians should be planting maize right now, but it's hard to do that when there are tanks in your fields. They should be harvesting their winter wheat fairly shortly, but again, it's difficult to harvest when there are tanks in your fields. And even if they could harvest, the Black Sea ports are closed. They can't move the grain they can harvest. Some proportion of it, presumably, can be sent by rail to the Polish border, then transshipped and exported via other ports. But what of the Russian grain harvests? Only a fairly modest proportion of those can be shipped from the Baltic, from Vladivostok via the Trans-Siberian, and that's to countries that don't have Russia under trade sanctions. Exacerbating a world food crisis by converting as much U.S. grain as possible into ethanol in order to burn it is not going to make the United States any more popular. And frankly, it's likely to cause an escalation in U.S. domestic food prices, which will be felt at least as bitterly as the escalation in motor fuel prices. It is completely baffling to me that no one would have pointed this out to Mr. Biden. Exactly whom does he have as advisors? Now, for the European Union to consider a 500 million euro assistance package to Ukraine, when they're sending something like 350 million euros every day to Russia for fuel, is really nothing short of contemptible. But whatever quantity of oil can be displaced by corn ethanol in the United States is not going to solve that problem. Ethanol from grain, after all, involves quite a bit of fossil fuel energy in the production, along with fertilizers and pesticides, which are largely produced from fossil fuels, and we shouldn't forget that those result in environmentally damaging runoff, although that doesn't have anything specifically to do with the fossil fuel supply situation. Plants to produce motor fuel from coal would be more of a solution. And in fact, back in the 1970s and 1980s, there was very active work going on in Germany on plants of that kind using process heat from high-temperature nuclear reactors. All that, of course, has gone by the wayside now. Not to mention, in all fairness, that it would take about 10 years for such plants to come into operation once they were ordered. And it certainly wouldn't do anything to help address global climate change. Not that much is really being done in that direction now. But let's talk about something else for a while. Rolly from Australia often gets up early in the morning on a weekend to listen to this show. And sometimes he responds in his show an hour later. And in his most recent show, he expressed some concerns about the use of nuclear energy on the grounds that it's something that, by its nature, does require and involve a lot of governmental control. And so his question is, what is the effect likely to be on personal liberties, civil rights, the freedoms that we rightly prize, and that I can certainly be found defending? Now, these are not exactly new questions, right? The anti-nuclear energy campaigners in the 1970s particularly very much liked to claim that nuclear energy would inevitably lead to fascism and intrusion of a police state into every aspect of life. We haven't really seen that happen, and there was never any particularly good reason to think that it would happen. It's true that nuclear energy requires strict control for public safety and security sorts of reasons, although the same really can be said of hydro, for example. Dam breaches have killed a lot more people than nuclear accidents, I can tell you that. It would be trivial to say that unless you work directly in the electricity supply industry, the kinds of controls and restrictions that are likely to surround nuclear energy are not going to be as significant in your life as the requirement that if you're going to keep a dog, you should have it vaccinated against rabies, or that if you're going to drive a motor vehicle, you must carry liability insurance for any damage you cause. I want to go a bit deeper. Because I would argue that large state-controlled electricity supply undertakings, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority or the Bonneville Power Authority in the United States, such as the former Hydroelectric Commission of Ontario, such as the former Central Electricity Generating Board in the United Kingdom, have not diminished people's freedom. To the contrary, they've enhanced it. What do I mean? Well, when people talk about freedom, most people talk about not being prevented from doing something or required to do something. This kind of negative definition of freedom comes from sort of 17th century thought. 17th century philosophers liked to imagine human beings in some kind of state of isolation coming together to form a society. But the absolute truth is there never has been any such person. We humans are social animals by nature. As Aristotle says in his Politics, it's impossible to conceive of a human being without a social context. And the pre-human ancestors we evolved from were also social. We grew out of societies that were already in existence. So if we consider, for example, a person dropped dead smack in the middle of the Nullarbor Plain of southern Australia. He is utterly free in the Enlightenment philosopher's negative sense. No one is going to restrain him from doing anything. No one is going to constrain him to do anything. But in practice, the only thing he's actually able to do is die of sunstroke. So all that freedom is kind of meaningless. Participating in a society, and particularly a modern, high-energy, high-technology society, for all that it may seem to impose limits on us from the viewpoint of negative freedoms, makes us much more free in the positive sense of being able and free to do things. If I want to go to Australia, I go to the airport, and I put money on the counter, and I get on an aeroplane, and they take me to Australia. I don't have to devise a means of getting to Australia. I don't even have to know how it's done. The ability to travel long distances around the globe has effectively become a part of the social fabric. In fact, I am reasonably persuaded that many people who travel to distant places have no clear idea where those places are. Now, the place where we need to be careful of our freedoms has to do precisely with the kinds of restrictions that are placed on these wonderful things that the high-energy, high-technology society allows us to do. Some of these restrictions are placed for very legitimate reasons, because we've discovered that the wonderful capabilities which our modern existence incorporates make it easy for people to do bad things that we don't want happening in our world, in our lives, and therefore some restraint has to be exercised. On the other hand, in many cases, it's a purely arbitrary exercise of power. You know, why is it that if I want to go to Germany, I can just get on an airplane and go to Germany, and at the German customs point, they will look at my passport and stamp it and say, all right, fine. And under the Schengen area rules, I can stay in Germany for 3 months out of any six. Whereas, if I want to go to Australia, I have to fill out an elaborate online form, something called a electronic travel authorization, and send it in with a payment, and wait for quite some time for that to be processed and validated. So the concern that Rowley expressed about centralized, government-controlled power supply entities, he referred to ancient Babylon and other societies in which the supply of a key factor of production, typically water, was used as a factor of control. And that's a legitimate thing to worry about. You know, there's a Larry Niven story, Rammer, which forms the first part of his novel A World Out of Time, in which the Earth is controlled by something he refers to as a water monopoly empire after the model of some of these ancient civilizations. There is a bureaucracy which controls the fusion power plants, which are also the source of fresh water, and they can tell everybody what to do because they can just cut off people's access to water and power. And that's certainly something to worry about, but I don't think it's really a consequence of this specific model of energy supply which we pursue. I think it's a matter of factors of social structure and our political ideals and expectations as much as anything else. Speaking of water supply, even more than electricity or telecommunications, one of the hallmarks of modern life is having essentially unlimited access to sanitary drinking water at the turn of a tap. I was on a job site a while back, and the contractor was telling me that the people insisted on getting their water from a well, which he'd drilled to a depth of more than 200 meters, but the well kept filling up with sand. Now, there was city water less than 200 meters away, and horizontal trenching tends to be a lot cheaper than vertical drilling. I don't know if this was an attempt at making a show of self-reliance. Strange thing for a human to aspire to in any case. But then, in Santiago, Chile, after more than a decade of water shortages, what's the solution that's been adopted? Not building seawater desalting plants. Not trying to find leaks in the pipes. In Lima, Peru, it's estimated that only about half of the water put into the system actually makes its way to customers, but rather arbitrarily disconnecting the water to large sections of the city on a rotating basis. I feel as though they could do better. And it's also really important not to delude ourselves with false visions. You know, the person who has a private automobile may say, well, I have more freedom because I can jump into my automobile and drive wherever I want, whenever I want, as opposed to modes of collective transport, such as the train. But there are two responses to that. Again, the first is that in your automobile, you are still very much reliant on the people who build and maintain the motorways. You are reliant on the people who operate the fueling stations, the truckers who bring the fuel to the fueling stations, the refinery operators, your government for maintaining good relations with the countries that provide the fuel, the navies of the world for keeping the sea lanes clear so that tankers can move. And so all of that social underpinning is somewhat hidden, whereas in the case of the train, it's much more exposed. But there's a second way to consider it, again, which is that for many of us, the train feels much more like freedom than the private car does. Because you can just turn up at the station and get on board and go to where you want to go, without having to worry about purchasing the automobile, maintaining the automobile, keeping it fueled. Those functions and costs and responsibilities, in effect, become a part of the social fabric, so that we don't have to worry about them. We can get on with our lives, we can do the things that are important to us, without having to attend to every detail which makes those things possible. Which, in a sense, is division of labor, another characteristic of the sophisticated society. But it's a division which rests as much on the physical structure that we've built as on a particularization of human activities. And of course, for people who may be, say, blind or suffer from seizure disorders, who can't or really, really shouldn't operate a private car, there's far more freedom in the collective transport. To make the analogy more perfect, when you're driving on the motorway, it often happens that you run into a traffic jam because there are a lot of people going more or less from the same place to the same place at the same time. And if you're in an area with a lot of home PV installations, it often happens that everybody in your area is reaching their peak solar output for the day at about the same time, which is not necessarily the time at which the demand for power is highest. With dispatchable transportation, such as trains, dispatchable power generation, this is far less of a problem. and I don't see the kind of measures that are taken to try and patch the situation, such as congestion tolls or per-appliance metering, as being in any way conducive to increased freedom. With central station grid power, the ability to light your home as you like, to cook your meals when and as you like, to wash and dry your clothes and dishes without labor whenever you like, becomes a part of the social fabric. You don't have to buy oil and keep your lamps filled and the wicks trimmed. You don't have to watch your battery charge levels and periodically open them up and add water. You can just flip the switch or set the timer and not worry about it. And to me, that certainly seems like freedom. So I want to encourage you to consider freedom to as well as freedom from, because the use of energy has vastly expanded our freedom too, and I believe that nuclear energy is the best way to maintain and expand those freedoms too. And we shouldn't forget that pre-industrial, pre-agricultural even societies, what some of us would call primitive societies, well, they've existed a long time and they've built up their own structure of restrictions. The fact is that in the typical tribal society, life is subject to all kinds of restrictions. You know, in the modern industrial world, we have quite totally abolished sumptuary laws, which tell you what you can and cannot wear based on the conditions of your birth. Those existed in English-speaking countries into the 19th century. We have abolished all these kinds of restrictions. Where you may and may not live, whom you may and may not marry, what occupation you may or may not take up, based on who your parents were, based on what time of the year you were born, what astrological sign you were born under. The so-called primitive societies, the pre-industrial, pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies, they have these kinds of restrictions in spades. In many cases, restrictions that make the U.S. federal tax code seem easy to deal with. I realize that's hard to believe, but it's true. And don't take my word for it, find a cultural anthropologist and ask. Anyway, I think that's all I have to say for this week. I've spoken before about being an autistic person, and April is, so I understand, Autism Awareness Month. So I'd just like to mention, please don't support organizations such as Autism Speaks with their puzzle piece symbol that implies the need for a solution to the existence of people like me. A better choice would be something like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, an organization which tries to amplify what autistic folks actually have to say rather than speaking for and, frankly, talking over us. As always, I look forward to receiving your cards and letters. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you think I'm doing a good thing with these broadcasts, you can always send me some money. I do appreciate it. PayPal.me/Prometheus Lives. And also in that vein, I have decided to activate the tipping option on the Man and Adam Tumblr site. Yes, I do have a Tumblr, man-and-adam.tumblr.com, and the kind of content I put up is pretty much what you would expect from listening to these broadcasts. Scans of booklets about atomic energy and space travel, my opinions on news stories. A lot of it is material, basically, that I want to have on the Man and Adam website when I eventually get that organized, which I've been procrastinating about doing. And now that I've gone to weekly posts for organizing the A Step Farther Out shows on and on radio, I'm going to be linking those from here on out to the Tumblr. I'm also thinking of producing a couple of A Step Farther Out video specials at some point. And if I could get enough income from various sources, I would absolutely put those into paid programming slots on television stations. I've been thinking about that for a long time, ever since I read that Google Ads would allow you to place television ads frequently in extremely cheap time slots. Anyway, I'm looking forward to doing the interview I have lined up with the student from NYU, and also the talk that I'm supposed to give to students from the Central Luzon State University. The excitement is almost overpowering! Anyway, you have been listening to A Step Farther Out, on a non-radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.